Welcome to Mysterious Universe, Season 30, Episode 2. Coming up on this show, we've got Lethbridge and the power of the pendulum, the psychokinetics of the deranged mind, and French phone calls from dead dogs. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
You stuffed it up. It was supposed to be French phone calls from the dead dogs.
I'm not doing that. It's bad enough as it is that you're putting this kind of low bar content in the headlines.
It is
phone
not,
calls from dead dogs.
It is not low bar at all. In fact, what's coming up is truly fascinating. So, you know, the old stories of telephone calls from the dead. You've got, you know, a D. Scott Rogo who wrote that fantastic book on it with Raymond Bayless. You've got even more recent reports. I mean, I found some French reports about telephone calls, but it just so happens that the telephone call from a deceased person wasn't from a human. It was allegedly from a dog.
So let me get this straight. It's French phone calls from dead dogs. It's not phone calls from French dead dogs.
It doesn't matter.
So you can just be a random person anywhere in the world and you get a call from a dead dog, but it's in French.
Look, I see where you're going. I see what you're saying. But no, it just so happens that the reports are French. No, this is actually from an article that was published a couple of years ago by Sharon Hewitt-Roulette. And it relates to a French parapsychological researcher.
Yeah, we've covered him on the show.
That's
exactly
right.
Who you're talking
he
about.
He started looking into experiences of telephone calls from the dead, but in France. And of course, if you recall, the book was never published.
Yeah, because we found her review.
That's right.
Her review of the draft or something. And we're pulling all these stories out of it.
Yeah.
But I think the book came out. It was just never in English.
That's right. Yeah, it's never been published in English. Well, I found a couple of extracts, which are more extreme examples of some of the experiences that people have had. But that's only a very kind of small part of the show that I've got coming up today. What I really want to dig my teeth into is the research, and coincidentally, Ben, you and I are covering the same guy today, of T.C. Lethbridge.
Yeah, Thomas Lethbridge.
This man is just truly incredible. He has published dozens of books. I think, in fact, after he left his university position, you were telling me, Ben, he published 15 books in 10 years?
Yeah, 15 books in 10 years. He was an archaeologist at Cambridge.
And a naturalist.
For a long time. He passed away in 1971, but he was at Cambridge until 1957, and he published 6 books that you would consider conventional archaeology. Like, he wrote the classic Boats and Boatmen in 1952. He wrote the history
Boats and How to Make Them Pay.
The history of the Picts in 1952. But then he published, I think his final academic book in 1957 was called Gogmagog, The Buried Gods.
Yeah.
And it was this one that really rubbed the orthodoxy at Cambridge the wrong way, because he claimed to have discovered a lost goddess from pagan history in the British Isles. It was really kind of fascinating. I don't know if you've got anything on this, but it really challenged the dogma of the time.
No, I did go into a few things that were along those lines, but I think you and I diverged on our path today, because the reason why I decided to look into his research, and, you know, to sum it up and make it very simple, ultimately this guy, I really like him because he comes across as someone who was very open-minded. He didn't give a damn about his reputation, and he even states it in one of his books, that he doesn't care what people are going to think about what he finds. He's an observer. He wants to observe what's going on. But the guy essentially was the creator of the stone tape theory.
Oh, really?
The idea that, you know, the ether around you, substances, stone, you know, materials, they absorb emotional energy. Emotional energy is not something that we can measure from, you know, the sense of what we're talking about today. And so it's never been scientifically been able to be measured or backed up. But what he has done is he's drawn on these experiences and observed the experiences of not only other people, but his own as well, and drawn some really stunning conclusions. And so essentially what this guy did is he came up with all of these really intriguing ideas about hauntings, you know, apparitions, doppelgangers, Vardigas, those sorts of things, before looking at any other research.
Well, I noticed that there were things that he would bring up, and he would have his own term for it. He would have his own terminology to try and understand what he was discovering.
Yes.
And tulpas was a good example. Like, yes. He was figuring out that thought forms seemed to manifest once enough energy was put into it. But it was clear that he had never heard of Alexander David Neil.
Nope.
He'd never heard of the term tulpas. It wasn't in his... And he was very narrow in his reading, because he was just an archaeologist for years, and that was his thing. He never really looked outside of it.
Well, I think think, though, he was being somehow, and he never says this, right, but reading between the lines, I feel like because of his work as an archaeologist, he was being pushed in a certain direction. And of course, being an archaeologist, utilizing extrasensory perception would be a fantastic thing for his research. And he actually ended up doing a whole heap of research into what is essentially psychometry.
Yeah. So out of those 15 books that he wrote in 10 years, he wrote books on psychometry. He did ancient history stuff. One of his latter books was on the idea of ancient aliens. And he was writing it at the same time as von Daniken. And it's like von Daniken just got his book out just before Lethbridge. And von Daniken got all the attention for it. But Lethbridge was working independently on the same ideas. Mm. And the book I'm going to be going into today is The Power of the Pendulum, which was his final book before he died in the 1970s. And his wife actually had to find all his notes and try and compile it. But this was fascinating because through his use of this pendulum measuring system, which is kind of like a version of dowsing, right, he started to discover other dimensions of existence.
Yeah, so
he was able to measure them.
But yeah, tell us about this, because the reason why I kind of got into the pendulum side of things is I was flicking through a book called ESP Beyond Time and Distance, and I just happened to be flicking through it. I was like, oh, for whatever reason, it's strange, right? This has been sitting in a box behind my desk for months now. I haven't gone anywhere near it.
Why did you get this out?
For some weird reason, I just had this feeling, almost like in a automatic writing kind of style, like some type of channeling. I was like, I need to go and look through this box. And I just pulled this book out and I started flicking through it. And I came to this page where he was describing, of all things, gypsum.
Fascinating.
Just fascinating,
it's
like
a,
right?
Fascinating as a like, dead French dog.
I'm like, oh my God, look at these mineral reports. And as I was digging through it, though, I realized that there was something that he was kind of hinting at, because he described picking up gypsum and saying that what you can do is you can take gypsum and run a pendulum over the top. And you'll go into the details of how that actually works later on, Ben. But he describes, you know, running the pendulum over the top and it will give off a certain kind of signature. And this is repeatable through a whole range of different materials. Each material gives off a certain kind of signature. However, that signature can be influenced. And he said, take that piece of gypsum or any other material that you dig out of the ground, which he has done on his archaeological digs, and carve it. Carve it into anything. Carve it into a ship, carve it into a door knocker, who cares, right? But then place it back down and run the pendulum over it once again. When you do that, it will start giving off a signature. And like a different signature. And that signature will still be the original of the gypsum, but it will also give you a signature that is distinctly male, right? And he realized at this point that something he was doing was like rubbing off him and into the item that he was creating.
Yeah, this was the big breakthrough with his pendulum work. He discovered that there was what he called a rate. And this is an old term prescribed with dowsing and pendulum work, is that essentially he has a pendulum which is attached to like a pencil like rod. Mm-hmm. And the length of thread that is attached to the actual bulb or the pendulum, whatever you'd call it, this has a certain length, right? So you'd wrap it around the pencil, for example, and you'd lower it over the whatever you're measuring, say it's like a silver fork on the floor. And at a certain length of that thread, it's like the pendulum will activate.
Come alive.
It'll start rotating. It'll start moving. And it's very obvious that it's being affected by something. And the rate is the length of that thread as it first starts to activate. So he noticed, for example, for silver, the rate was 22 inches.
Yep.
Right?
And gold was 25, I think.
Yeah, gold was 25. And he started to measure this over all these objects. But the breakthrough came when he discovered you could measure ephemeral things. You could measure concepts, ideas.
I haven't gone anywhere near that.
You could measure love and hate.
Really?
And it kind of reminded me of, what's the Japanese water crystal researcher again?
Masamoto? Masamoto?
Masamoto. Similar to that idea where he was measuring the effect of words on the water crystals.
That's right. He would scream at water or freeze it.
He would just write a horrible word and stick it on a frozen water bottle.
Yeah.
But Lethbridge was noticing the same thing, that he was able to detect rates in concepts and ideas. And those ideas, the rates started to match. Like, for example...
He was observing consistency.
You could have, I think the rate for night was 40, but the rate for death was also 40.
Oh, really?
The rate for lies and darkness was also 40. And then he would look at, I think 20 was east, and east corresponded to fire, which also corresponded to heat, which also had the same measurement as light, and also Bulgaria for some reason. And I actually found he would do this with countries. So he would go through, and there's a rate measured for the United States. There's one for England and Australia. And later on in the show, it reveals quite a lot about the character of your country.
Is it like a shithole rate?
And to a certain degree, Australians are slightly retarded, according to Les Bridges.
Yeah, I believe that.
psychically
yeah,
speaking.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course.
So there's all these fascinating correspondences he started to discover. And he thought that 40 inches, because that's death, right? That's where things cut off. He was like, okay, so that's, you're not going to measure anything past that because that's death. Until he discovered that there was another dimension that the pendulum would detect beyond the edge of death.
Oh.
And this is where, say, I was talking about the silver fork, for example.
Mm.
There would be a corresponding effect of that silver fork in the next dimensional measure. So, for example, you might find like the astral silver fork would appear at like 66 inches on the pendulum effect. And I'll go into this in more detail to explain it, but it's essentially it starts to correlate with reports that you hear from eyewitnesses who have near-death experiences and OBEs.
Interesting.
Of where they basically end up. Like, you know, we hear so many stories of people who pop out of their body and they're like, well, I was floating above my body and I was in the corner of the room. Lethbridge actually came up with an explanation as to why that's where you first pop
really?
Out.
Really?
Yeah. It was all through his pendulum research.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, because that was his last book, he must have been, you know, developing his theories and fleshing them out. Because in Ghost and Ghouls, Ghost and Ghoul, this is where he starts focusing on why people have these certain experiences, why people see apparitions, what they experience. And it's really amazing, actually. It's another example of someone who is heavily involved in the academic world, but also something, whether it's within their or something external, but it's kind of pushing them, like showing them examples, like showing them, hey, there's more to this. And the person kind of reluctantly being pulled along with it, because this is what's happened once again with all these sorts of people his entire lifetime. He's had a lifetime of these experiences, and I think he's kind of pushed them to the side or to the back of his mind. And yet it all sort of, kind of accumulates later on and precipitates some of these really incredible breakthroughs that
he had. I'm interested in hearing his early experiences, because I kind of skipped a lot of that and just went into his conclusions at the end. So why don't you kick it off and we'll learn about what he went through.
We'll do that. So, I mean, the guy was already controversial early on in his career when he was using the pendulum, for example. One of the examples he provides is that I think it was like a collection of fossilized mollusks or something along those lines. It doesn't matter, but it was fossils, and they have a sex, you know, it was male or female. And apparently it was relatively difficult to work out what sex they were. And he was just like male, female.
Right.
And he could just like work it out really quickly. And so he was going back to his colleagues at the museum and at the university. And they were kind of getting frustrated because they were saying, how are you so readily and rapidly doing this? He's like, pendulum.
Yeah.
He pulls out the pendulum.
Yeah. He was doing this with ancient skulls at Cambridge as well.
Right.
He was sexing the skulls and people were astonished because it was accurate every time.
Yeah.
It was just like, zoop, zoop, zoop.
Oh, it's amazing, you know, how he was able to do this. And of course he got a lot of pushback. And, you know, as I pointed out, like, he didn't care about his reputation. It's like, I'm observing. This is what I was brought up to do. I was brought up to observe and to see what's going on in the world.
Funnily enough, he said that the old guard was way more open-minded than the next generation that came through.
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
He's like, all my old friends have passed away. Like, when he left Cambridge, he's like, there's a new orthodoxy that it's very rigid in its thought. He called it like some kind of union. It was like a trade union. He used to make fun of it. It's like
a consortium.
Yeah, you can't have these new ideas because the union will block you.
Yeah.
And that's what it turned into.
That's very much what happened. Although he does point out in one of his earlier works in Ghost and Ghoul that he says, look, you know, ghosts have confronted many an archaeologist. You know, it's something that seems to happen to people that are in this field. And that kind of makes sense, right? You're digging in graveyards, you're digging in these, you know, traditionally haunted locations anyway, but there's a reason why they're traditionally haunted. It's not, and if we put aside the idea that it's disembodied spirits, that it's something else, it's some type of natural phenomena. He's like, yeah, that happens. But he says, I seem to be more prone to bumps in the night than others are. I seem to have these, you know, strange experiences that the majority of my friends and acquaintances and colleagues do not. And to me, it's no longer a taboo to admit this. But in the recent years, you know, he has faced a lot of pressure and, you know, stress of being able to describe this. But it just so happens that around the time that he was congealing these ideas and coming forward with his experiences, you've got people like J.B. Ryan, for example, that were doing all of their research. And there's this one piece of research that he refers to, which, you know, really stands out well in highlighting that J.B. Ryan was conducting research where they would get people to throw dice and they would get people to focus their intention on the dice.
Yeah,
and
right.
By focusing their intention, they could change the outcome statistically significantly as to what that dice would come up as. And so it's like, it's quite clear that there's a psychokinetic effect taking place here, even though it's dice, like it's very small. But although, you know, to me, that's incredible. But then you start thinking of things like when people are at casinos and they've got, you know, good luck charms or some type of ritual in the way that they do things. Intention actually plays this huge role in forming psychokinetic abilities.
Yeah, this is what he was starting to discover.
Yeah.
Is that mind is matter. They're not two separate things.
Absolutely. Well, it's even more than that, right? He kind of points out that there seems to be some type of mechanism which completely bypasses the brain, right? So the brain is completely, it's not physical. There's something else which allows people to access their mind directly, and that mind does have an effect on our physical reality. But our physical reality essentially is this, it's a malleable substance, I suppose, is what we can confer. And, you know, later on, as he starts talking about the elements of psychometry, and by the way, he actually dismisses psychometry. It's like it's useless. Something actually does happen. It actually does work.
Why is it useless?
But it's useless. So actually, we'll jump into the psychometry stuff early on, because he essentially, when he starts forming these ideas, he wants to get people around him that are sensitive to what's going on, right? And he says that some people are essentially transmitters of this phenomena and other people are receivers. So when people have experiences of seeing ghosts, apparitions, these forms, it actually comes down to the person being sensitive to it. And he describes this earlier experience when he was a young man. I mean, he must have been in his late teens or early 20s. He was living in this particular home with other students or other academics, and he was sitting down in this little sitting room that was in the bottom of the house. And as he's sitting there, he has a colleague or a friend who's sitting in a chair across from him. And as he's sitting, this other man in this large top hat, like this big top hat, just walks in, doesn't say anything at all, just comes in, kind of looks around the room, but with this blank stare, which is so typical of all these experiences. He places his hands upon a table and then is there for a moment and then just casually leaves. Now, as he's casually leaving, Lethbridge stands up and goes to leave as well, and kind of says something along the lines of good evening to you or something. And he's ignored. Like he's totally ignored. He doesn't think anything of it and he lets it go. Now, a couple of days later, he bumps back into his housemate who was sitting in that chair at the time when this man had walked in, and just through coincidence starts talking about, oh, wasn't it rude with that chap that totally ignored us?
Is this the guy he saw that was wearing a hunting outfit?
I think he was wearing a hunting outfit.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
It was just odd as well.
Odd.
Like, who is this guy
there was something,
in an old hunting outfit?
Yeah, there was just something a bit weird about it.
Like old middle ages.
Yeah.
Like he was there for the Renaissance fair.
Yeah, I think he said it was almost like he was 14th century attired or something.
Yeah.
It was just something that was off, but not so off that it would, you know, draw his attention to it. And his friend or acquaintance that had been sitting in the chair and had been in the room, had full view of the room, was like, I don't know what you're talking about. There was no one in the room at all. And it very quickly dawned on Lethbridge that he had seen an apparition. I don't want to say ghost, because he doesn't even use the term ghost. It might be something that's, you know, kind of put out there to the layperson. And this is not by any means, it doesn't have that feeling of him being, well, I'm an academic and I know better than everyone. It's not like that. It's just like, his theories are very natural. He's like, this is a natural phenomena. And for whatever reason, he must be sensitive to this range of phenomena. And he picked up on it. He said, I must be at the frequency. I must be attuned just naturally to pick up on these things. And that's why I'm seeing it. And we've heard this in other research as well. You've had a whole heap of, you know, clairvoyants and, you know, other people that are, you know, inclined to see these things say, Some people just can't see it.
How does this connect to psychometry?
So with psychometry, right, so he starts to understand that, hang on a second, if I'm tuned into this, there must be a field, there must be something you can tap into, there must be an energy, it has to be something. Well, he never uses directly the term energy. He kind of, this is the path that he goes down. So after he has this experience, it kind of triggers memories of other experiences that he's had, which I'll come back to in a moment. But essentially with the psychometry, he dives into the deep end because he comes down to this understanding that, look, you can use sensitives. And these sensitives, who may be more sensitive than him, could be very effective at archaeological dig sites, for example. And so he meets up with this young woman, and she seems to be a person who was highly sensitive to this phenomena. And funny enough, though, I must point out, the guy actually has this great sense of humor in that he says, look, what you can do is, he comes up with the concept of ghost jammers. And what ghost jammers are, right? Ghost jammers are any type of instrument that you can use to prevent these apparitions or these energies from pervading into your home or into your life, right? And so guess what's a good ghost jammer? A crucifix. Like these objects, yeah, right. You can use them to block this stuff.
Yeah, I've got a story similar to that coming up where he tests this concept against a witch.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is where, like in Ghost and Ghoul, he goes into these ideas of black magic actually being effective at any type of magic because it comes down to intention. It comes down to you forming a link. But really what it is, he says, look, there could be entities that are operating from the other side that are, influencing things, coming through and, making contact with, loved ones, that kind of thing. But for him, he's like, I think this is more to do with some type of natural phenomena connected to intention and connected to a link between people, right? And so this link between people, this is where the psychometry comes in because he very rapidly realizes that psychometry is not necessarily about accessing a point in time that's recorded in that object. It may be, he points out, but he doesn't seem to think that's the case because he describes a couple of experiences that he has with his sensitive. So he talks to his sensitive and he produces a number of objects for the sensitive. And he says, oh, can you...
Artifacts.
Artifacts, that he's pulled out from digs and those sorts of things. And he says to her, can you, have a look at these objects and see what you can find? And she's like, yeah, of course. And so he gives her like an old Roman brooch, for example, or a piece of timber that's come, from a shipwreck that she doesn't know any of this. Like, yep. She has no knowledge. It's very much like remote viewing where they're just given the coordinates but have no knowledge of what they're looking at. She does exactly the same thing. She's given these objects. And before I go into what she sees with these objects, Lethbridge is already forming some theories around what these things are, how people see psychometry. And he starts referencing like the ancient Egyptians with their concept of ka and their being essentially that it's not just the person, right? It's actually the objects as well. We leave this radiant energy signature that's all around us. And I guess it can be sometimes viewed as being like a Curlian photography may pick it up. It's like an aura, but it's not actually an aura. It's something else, which is kind
of a piece of our mind.
Right, exactly. But even objects have it, right? And he says, what you can do is you can take an object like this pen I'm holding right now, Ben, and I can take this object away, but it will leave its kind of resonance, its energy lying there. And so it may be picked up on by a sensitive for whatever reason. And he says these objects for certain people that can see them, everything does have this aura around it. You can actually see it. And it's funny because we've only just been talking about like the idea of the flaming plasma recently and people having, even I was thinking as I was driving to work this morning, the idea of people saying, oh, when I see a UFO, it's got this weird blue haze around it. And all, in the past, I've always thought maybe that was some type of radiation effect or, some type of propulsion side effect. But then I'm like, is it actually some type of connection to what we've been talking about, like with that plasma coming through or it being permitting the item to enter into our world? And in fact, there's a fleeting reference to Lethbridge having a sighting of a UFO, but I couldn't find the actual story. So it's funny that he's looking at this phenomena and he wrote about it. Right. So going back to the psychometry, so with each and every one of these objects, there's this aura, there's this energy around it. But then his ideas start to collide with the concepts of tulpas, thought forms, and your thoughts and intentions, once again, manipulating these energy fields and this reality around us. Because he says with these particular objects, with these lights coming off them, when he gives them to his sensitive assistant, One's really fantastic. He hands her this piece of wood, which has come from, and he knows it's come from a shipwreck, right? He knows the details about it. And she describes this incredible scene of these men, you know, rushing about on deck, and there being a battle taking place, and there's cannonballs flying. It's just this incredible kind of scene. And she's, like, she's almost there. It's like she's picking up so much on this energy. And he's like, oh, okay, well, that's pretty incredible. He has no way to validate any of this, right? He just reports what she describes. But he says, look, maybe she's onto something, because I do know that this particular piece of wood, it did come from this ship that we believe was involved in this particular battle. And she picked up on that. She had no way of knowing any of that. But you can go, that was already his theory, right? But you can see where he's going with this, right? Because that was his theory. That was already in his mind. You know, and obviously, still piecing it together from history, where he's, you know, used his archaeological research and other records to work out kind of what's going on. But then he passes her this little copper ring of some kind, or a metal copper-colored ring.
Yeah.
And she picks this thing up and she's like, oh, you know, I'm cold, and it's like, oh, but it's definitely in England. And, you know, it turns out that it's chainmail, right? But she doesn't know that. She just sees this ring
little,
of metal.
Link,
she's got, and he's like, yeah, it is. It's chainmail. Like, she's able to pick up on it. And, you know, she's kind of amazed with this, and so is he. So she's definitely seeing something. This woman definitely has some type of ability. But the ability, much like the whole idea of the living ghost, like the idea with seances, right, where people go to a seance and you've got the living agent hypothesis, where essentially when a deceased one, an alleged deceased one, comes through and they're answering questions about people in the room, it's actually the medium drawing upon the memories and the minds of the people in the room, and that's how they're able to get the information.
That's one theory. Right?
It's a theory. Like, I'm not saying that that's what's happening, but it does kind of fit in with his ideas, right? Because what the object, he starts to work out that she's holding, it doesn't matter what the object is. The object, though, is actually a link between his mind and hers. And it's like, well, hang on a second. Like, how is it then that she's pulling up this information about these ancient battles and this chainmail? Well, it becomes very apparent to him. His hypothesis starts to gel when one particular evening he'd been conducting these series of tests with her. And he says, oh, just a moment, I have to go and put my son into bed. And so he goes upstairs, and he had this, you know, ritual, which we all do, of, you know, when he goes to bed, he would read his son a story, or tell his son a story. And his son's like, tell me a story. So he's like, oh, and he didn't have anything to read. So he just starts making up this story. And he makes up this incredible story of how it's, you know, these warring 14th or 15th century Romans. And he describes their swords and, you know, the scene that's taking place and all this incredible kind of stuff, right? And, you know, Bubs goes off to sleep and he wanders back downstairs. And his sensitive is there. She's like, oh, this item, and oh, it's just incredible. She starts telling him, and she hasn't heard anything. Like, he's in the opposite end of the house. She has no way of picking up, you know, what he's been talking about. She's like, it's this battle, and it's this scene, and it's these Romans that are fighting each other, and they've got these swords. And she starts describing these swords in detail. And she's like, the swords are at the, you know, I can see them in a pile in the room, and these swords are actually glowing, and she can see all the energy around the swords, right? Yeah. Like the auras around the swords. But what she's describing, the way that she's detailing these instruments, these swords, like, it's very detailed. It's incredible what she's describing. But he's like, this is something what a person thinks about, you know, being a sword from the past looks like. He's like, they don't actually look like that.
Right, right.
They don't look like that. And he's like, but hang on a second.
That's the story.
Yeah. Everything that she had just described was the story that he had just told his son, that he had made up on the fly.
Is she holding the link when she's
holding
doing this?
It. She's holding the object. She's like, well,
and when did he tell this story to his son? Did he have the link when he was telling the story?
No, she was holding the object, right? But he had...
While he was telling the
story. He had given her the object, and he said, hang on a minute, I had to go upstairs and put my son to bed.
Yeah.
And she was like, no worries, I'll just keep on hanging on to this object until you come back.
He described a similar thing in The Power of the Pendulum, where at the start of the book, he talks about this great dilemma, and he basically boils it down to two camps of thinking about truth and the existence of everything, you know, the universe. And he says you've got one camp that would say everything's ordered by God and some grand intelligence, and the other camp that says everything's by chance. And the way he wrote about it, he says it's kind of like an angry bull with two horns, right? This is the great dilemma. And these two horns, there's like each side is the way to think about the universe. And he was basically writing this in his notes as he was, you know, going to bed with his wife next to him, and he's reviewing it while he was going to, before he went to sleep. Anyway, the next morning, his wife wakes up and she's like, I just had the weirdest dream last night that there was this horrible bull with two giant horns and it was just charging at me. This, I can't get the horns out of my mind. And he's like, read my manuscript. And it was basically this thought that he had created. She had somehow picked it up. So, yeah, he was still very much thinking in terms of thoughts being projected, becoming thought forms. He never uses the term tulpa.
Never. No.
But it's basically what he's describing.
Well, he ends up, you know, developing this idea when he has a later experience with the ghoul, which I'll go into in a moment. But essentially with the psychometry stuff, you know, he goes, well, look, I'm not saying that psychometry is useless, but it's definitely useless in the context of me wanting to use it for archaeology.
Because he totally changes his tune by the book I'm reading.
Does he really?
He's like, psychometry works in archaeology. He's found a ton of stuff with it.
Oh,
he uses it all the time.
Well, because, yeah, like he was convinced that the object, right, is the link between the minds. And then he starts to realize this is how things like magic works, you know, whether it's beneficial or negative magic, that's how it works. So when you hear people using certain magic, like taking clippings, like nail clippings or hair clippings or a bit of blood, you know, this is the link. This is what's happening. This is how it's used to transport this intention. And this is also how you have people having ghost experiences and those sorts of things, because it comes down to there being a wanting, and emotion plays a huge role in this. And this is why it's like people that are mourning for lost loved ones seemingly can cause apparitions to appear. And he describes this experience he had when he was a kid, right? He was a young kid. I don't know exactly how old he was, but he was living in this little house and his mother was renting it. And the house was fine, except for this one bedroom, right? This one particular bedroom was really uncomfortable. He just didn't like it at all. But he was in this bedroom. He said it was small, but it had a feeling about it. And the feeling was is that it suddenly got very cold at times, like very, very cold, much like what we hear in many paranormal reports of people seeing ghosts and other, you know, haunting and apparitions. And he said that, it would freak him out. It would absolutely disturb him. But he said it was also the tree. There was something about this cypress tree outside that really bothered him. And it was like something flowed off the tree in through the window. It was just like an energy, a feel.
Like a possum?
No, not like it was something that was just uncomfortable. It wasn't terrifying, but it was certainly uncomfortable. Now, as a young boy, you know, he doesn't know what this is or what's going on. But he finds out years later, and obviously, you know, he doesn't have any conclusive theories about what exactly this is. But he does come up with a very intriguing hypothesis. He says that, look, this house that we rented, the mother that had the woman who owned the house, she was a mother. And she had lived there with her son. And her son had grown up climbing in that cypress tree. Now, sadly, her son had died. Now, I don't know if he had died in the war as a young adult or what had happened to him. But essentially, she had spent a great deal of time pining for her son and focusing on that tree where he used to climb. And it's like basically he believes that what was going on is that she was focusing her intention on that tree, but also she wanted to kick them out because she wanted to return to that home, but she had to reluctantly rent it out. So that negative energy of her wanting to remove the tenants was flowing through from the intention on that tree directly through that window into his place.
Weird.
Which is why he was picking up on it. And this is what happens to a lot of people. A lot of people.
Is that the ghoul?
No, well, yes, that's the ghoul, right? So you're very, the ghoul.
I thought the ghoul was this weird thing that he saw at the bottom of the staircase when he was at university.
Oh, I'll come back to that one as well. No, the ghoul itself is a term, it's an encompassing umbrella term that he uses to describe this energy that pervades things, right? And people, and when you walk into it, it's freezing, right? It's this, you feel it, like it's like a wall that you smash into.
Yeah, yeah.
And he actually later on describes it, it's like, it's not energy in the sense that we know, because we can't. We can't prove any of this stuff. I know, like, he talks about J.B. Ryan, and it's a little bit depressing as well in some sense reading this book in, you know, modern times, because he's talking about the research of J.B. Ryan, and they were doing cutting-edge research. It was before there was this real stigma and dogma around this kind of stuff, where they were going, there is something more to this. And he was kind of, like, hopeful for the future. And I'm like, mate, if you saw what it's like now, it's like, no! Snopes said that's not real. Yeah. Like, that's where we've gotten
to. A lot of these guys have that. Like, especially if you read books from the 1970s, there's this huge optimism about
yes.
how these new ideas and these new discoveries are going to change society, and we're going to have this completely new understanding of life and energy in the universe. And it just never happened. It got worse. We became more materialistic.
There's so many people out there as well with a stick up their ass that they just really want to hang on to the, I'm right, you're wrong, because I follow the science. And it's like, particularly in this field, it's in a whole heap of things. But I was reading today more about the stone tape theory. And, you know, there's this particular blogger who I won't give their name because they hate us, but essentially they were describing that, well, the stone tape theory is garbage. It starts listing like the reason why quartz can't transmit energy. And I'm like, that's not, you're getting too caught up, right, on the actual, the hardcore materialistic concepts here. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't measure this stuff yet because it's types of energy fields and concepts that just have not been recognized by science yet.
Well, we don't have the instruments.
We don't have the instruments to measure it.
Yeah.
So, and like, this is just, and this is why this works, right? We have to hypothesize, we have to consider, we have to have open conversations and not directly dismiss things out of hand. But it seems like for some people, they don't even want to possibly entertain this stuff unless it's been peer reviewed by 30 different journals that are all leaning the same way.
Mm.
It's a really disgusting thing to see, actually, because you're right. Like, there's so much hope in this book. And I turn around today and it's just like, it's not there. But look, one thing I will say is, you know, like the fact that you're listening to this show, there are just so many people out there now that have a hunger for knowing more and looking at the other possibilities of what could be occurring. And this is exactly what happened to him. So he describes, you know, a few of these experiences of encountering the ghoul. So he had that experience when he was a child. You know, he skips forward to the experience he has as a young man. But then, like, he starts traveling around, right? And he's going to the Sheant Islands, which I think are these...
something in Scotland?
Yeah, it's like it's a British island or a collection of islands. And essentially there was this abandoned monastery there, right? And he goes to this particular island and he starts moving around and he all of a sudden has an experience, right? He walks into like this wall. It's like he walks into a cloud of this stuff, whatever it is. No one else can see it. No one else can feel it, but he does. And yeah, of course, this stuff could be, I mean, he's on an island and it's bloody freezing there. So yeah, maybe it's just some type of morphology of the island which causes that particular area to be colder. And that would be fine if it was just that one experience. But in the people that he's spoken to and the research that he's done, this is a repeatable constant that everyone has. It's like you pass into this cold field. And he kind of, you know, hypothesizes by saying maybe this is a drop in the energy, because it's whatever this is, like it still needs energy to manifest. Mm. So it draws upon, and obviously he doesn't use the term zero point, but it kind of feels like that. It's like drawing on the energy of the ether. And in doing so, that causes a massive drop in temperature. Like it's just natural because it pulls all the energy out of the surrounding area.
Is that all that happens? He just experiences a cold spot?
Well, it's that, but not on top of that, though, it's coupled with the feeling, right? Like he walks into it, and not only does he actually feel cold, he also feels an internal cold. Like he feels this daunting, horrible
dread.
You got to get out of there. Like, you got to get out of there. And he was like, oh, I really wanted to explore these ruins. And he's like, oh, no, I need to get out. Like, I just need to go. And so he does, right? He leaves, and then almost immediately this oppressive feeling just kind of, and he's right, you know? So later on, just through coincidence, and this is what happens to a lot of these people, he has these coincidences where it goes through the grapevine, and he starts to go to a local pub, and somehow this information just must seep through and get to people. And this priest contacts him, right? And this priest is like, look, I just wanted to give you, you know, a little bit of information about this particular monastery in the island, or these ruins that you're at. I think you're a very good person, because what was going on is that this island, you know, centuries ago was inhabited by filthy pagans. And so the Christian monks had all gone in and tried to convert them.
I know this. I've got other books where researchers speak about this and have had strange experiences at the same place.
Right. Well, what he was saying is that they couldn't, this priest was suggesting that when they went there, it was almost like they had to destroy this energy. He's like, we couldn't, it was too powerful. So what we did is we suppressed it, right? And we converted everyone to Christianity and things were fine. But at one point, the monks left. And when the monks left, this oppressive feeling was the power of darkness on the island. And this priest says to Lethbridge, these powers wish to get rid of you because of your value to the power of light. And Lethbridge is like, oh, well, that's very flattering, but I don't believe that's the case at all. But later on, because, that's why I like it. Like, I like him because he really is not trying to make it about him. He's just like, but in a way, like reading this book and looking into his research today and what other people have said about him, it does appear that he was onto something. He was beginning to understand this alternative understanding of our reality.
He seemed to be sensitive to these energies as well. There's
very much
sure you're going to mention it, but the story of his going out into the like a forest path with his mother, and they both just started to feel overwhelmed by what you described earlier, this dread again. Like, there's something's wrong with this area. This is awful. I don't know what it is, but we've got to get out of here. And his mother's like, yeah, I feel it too. Let's get out of here. So they leave this forested area. They get off the path. And a few days later, they see in the headlines that exactly where they were standing, someone found a body of someone who had killed themselves.
Yeah.
And he was convinced that the misery of this individual had, like stone tape theory that you're describing, it had essentially imprinted itself on the area where they were.
And they'd picked up on it.
They'd picked up on it, yeah.
Well, because there seems to be a genetic element. And while he doesn't say that either, he does kind of hint at there being a hereditary nature to this.
Oh, he goes into that in The Power of the Pendulum.
Does he?
He claims that gypsies bred for psychic abilities. he doesn't explicitly say that, but he hints at it.
Oh, see, that's...
It's this selective breeding, kind of eugenics for psychic abilities.
Gypsies actually come up. There's this very short, fleeting story, right, where many, many years later, and he's had all these experiences, and he's kind of coming up with these different ideas and understandings. And he says this gypsy woman just knocks at his door one day, and he opens up the door. And she comes in and she starts, I don't know, she wants to tell him about, you know, her premonitions and her experiences and that kind of stuff. And she says, look, I'll do it in exchange for this silver coin. And he's like, what silver coin? And she got angry at him. She was like, you've got this silver coin. You know, it's this large silver coin. He's like, I don't have a silver coin, lady. I don't know what you're talking about. And the woman threw a baby at him and left, you know, like the traditional gypsy way. And he's like, that was odd. Like, that was really strange. And I mean, I'm probably being a little bit, you know, mean to her because she did give some, you know, intriguing ideas to him. But I think it was, I don't know if it was a year later, it's a while afterwards, he was on this dig, right? And as he's on this dig, he unearths the exact large silver coin that this woman had seen. But it was a year later.
Yeah, it's the time distortion.
It's this time distortion. And look, I make, you know, no qualms about this.
He discovers why this happens with his pendulum experiments years later.
Oh.
He's got a full explanation for it.
Okay, because he says, like, he was like, towards the end of this book, he's like, make no doubt about it, time doesn't exist.
Yeah.
I'm like, what?
Well, it does.
But not in the sense that we think.
Not in every layer of existence.
Yes. Yeah, which is why. And so essentially what he's describing, reading between the lines with that gypsy woman, is that gypsy woman was able to tap into that and she could see, like, she got confused because she doesn't see that linear time. She just saw that he is in possession of this gold, this silver coin. And he wasn't. He would be one day, but he wasn't back then.
Did she want the silver coin?
She wanted it. Yeah.
Do they have no shame, these people? Just like begging from like some time traveling beggar.
Yeah. Pretty
like in the future, you're going to get some money and I would like it, please.
Yeah, that's pretty much what occurred. But so that's actually on the Last Plus episode, we were talking about haunted bathrooms. He has one of these experiences with the haunted bathroom,
great.
Right? But before we go into that, I want to go back to this ghoul because you raised a good story there, Ben, about how he and his mother, you know, had that experience with, wandering through the forest. Well, he had similar experiences with colleagues and even his wife at one point, right? And he returns to one of these islands. I think he gets invited to an Irish island of some kind. And I believe he goes with his wife and they're there and his wife has this incredibly uncomfortable experience where she goes to a certain spot and she hits that ghoul. Like the ghoul arrives and it's like she's completely enveloped. Like it's like a gas that just kind of all around her. And she's like, oh, I feel so depressed and I feel so horrible. And a voice is just like, now's the time to jump. Like it just comes from nowhere, right? It's something along those lines. And she's like, what the? And she kind of throws herself back and out of the ghoul and she's okay. Now she rushes off and she goes and tells Lethbridge about
time to jump.
So what had happened was this was like the last thoughts of the person that had committed suicide jumping from that very location. Well, he assumes that would have been the last thoughts that came. But essentially, it was a suicide spot and they didn't know that. And you can make the conclusion that, yeah, look, it's a a high point where you could jump from. But essentially, this was a not readily used, but it was a used suicide spot. And so she had picked up on that energy. It was like the last intense emotional energy that was somehow imprinted onto that very location that she encountered.
And then you have the question of, well, is that energy sentient? You know, does it have thoughts? Is it a being? Is it alive?
Yes.
And I think
but
it is.
Later.
It is. It's because if the idea of tulpas and thought creation is they are independent sentience. They're not created by thought energy.
You're right. Not initially, though. They don't appear to be initially. And this is like why with many of these ghosts and apparitions that people experience, that they're always kind of just like blank-faced. They ignore people.
Right. It's very limited.
Because it does carry the essence of the person, if not in their, you know, their image, but actually in the essence of what the person's character is. But for the most part, it's just this blank stare that does nothing. And funnily enough, he also points out that with a lot of these apparitions, because there's those old, you know, depictions of ghosts where it's like it's something that's grey, you know, or like a white misty form. With a lot of these ghosts, when people describe these apparitions, they're always just a little bit pale. Like they're pale. Sometimes they're like a black and white kind of reproduction. Even with the top hat guy, right? He realizes later on that he's like, I realized that he was black and white. Like it wasn't a full, even though at the time he was like, oh, this man is just standing here. And he's like, I didn't look at his face properly. But now I think of it, his face was gray. You're like a black and white television set. Now he goes into why this could be a link and maybe he'd picked up on something that was being projected by someone else. It actually reminded me a lot of his research about that concept that we discussed a while back, Ben, of people that have, you know, strange hauntings and experiences with apparitions and wraiths in brand new home builds. And we find out later on that there's a cemetery that's like four blocks over, but then there's a waterway that runs from the cemetery underneath their house.
Yeah, right.
And the idea is it's like those telluric currents is one concept that was used, is that the movement of water is taking that energy and the impressions from that graveyard and transmitting it into the house. And somehow the house is, for whatever reason, picking up on that and the people that are inside picking up on it. And so going back to the island, right, where his wife had this experience, in some of these islands that he visits, he gets these stories about the lighthouse itself on this particular island, and he's got a colleague. It's like, oh, there's something about this lighthouse. And of course, what are lighthouses? How often do you hear stories of haunted lighthouses? It's quite frequently.
Why?
I don't know. I don't know what it is. And it seems like some lighthouses are particularly more haunted than others. And why is that? Could it just simply be, is it the isolation? Is it that people are trapped with their thoughts and these isolated? I mean, they're all automated now. But back in the past, they were in remote locations or in locations where people are usually by themselves.
A lot of time to brood.
And they, you know, spew all this energy into the surroundings, and then it maybe causes a haunting. But this is where we come to the headline for the show, which is the term that I use, which is the psychokinesis.
French dead dogs.
No. That's a very small thing that's got really nothing. It was just a joke line. But with this is the psychokinesis of the deranged mind, right? And it just so happens that the new lighthouse keepers on this island, well, they are new, right? And he's like, why are they new? And he's like, oh, the last two keepers, you know, had to get kicked out because they had a weird experience. It's like, what do you mean they had a weird experience? So there was this terrible wreck that happened off the coast.
Right? Seems unfair that you get fired for having a weird experience.
Well, no, they broke down.
Okay, they left
right. Because they broke down. So essentially what had happened was is that there was this vessel that wrecked on the rocks through no fault of the lighthouse keepers. It was just, for whatever reason, this ship was wrecked and it caused a considerable loss of life. And these poor lighthouse keepers, all they could do was stand, like they stood on this cliff and watched as this vessel sank. And truly a traumatic thing, and there's nothing they could do. And this feeling of helplessness, all of this energy, right? All of this emotional energy brewing up. Now, they'd watched this thing take place. I don't know exactly how many people died, but it doesn't matter. Even one was enough. And the ship sinks and the scene ends, right? That's kind of over. So they go back for the evening and they just try to go on about their evening, and they make up their dinner and they start having dinner. And as they're having dinner, suddenly the door is kicked in and they hear, like, all this stamping of feet, like this running. And all these people run into the lighthouse and start tearing the place up, right?
But what?
There's no one there. There's no one.
They see the people or they just hear
it? They just hear it.
Okay.
In very much like a Vardiga kind of thing, and this is why the Vardiga comes up, is that they hear it, right? But there's also the psychokinetic effects in the fact that the door is swung open, things are knocked off shelves, they can hear the pounding on the pavement, which would be consistent with a person actually standing there. It was basically like these people were invisible, right? And so Lethbridge comes to this intriguing idea. He says, look, what this is the power of the mind to enact psychokinetic influence upon the nature of reality is abundantly clear. And this is where he goes back to and refers to the cutting edge research at the time of J.B. Ryan, but he also points out from his own experiences, this is psychokinesis. Your mind is somehow capable of influencing things. This is why you have, poltergeist experiences, all this kind of stuff. It's not an external entity. Now, the idea was here is that perhaps—
Why isn't it the ghosts of all the dead who are blaming the lighthouse keepers for not warning the ship?
Exactly.
The coast is right there.
That's exactly where most people go, right? That's where I went immediately. I was like, well, clearly, like, the ghosts of these people— And if you read stories like what W.T. Stead described, apparently this was channeled, but what W.T. Stead described after dying on the Titanic, and he just said that all these people that had also drowned and had, died of hypothermia were just hanging about. Mm. They're just milling about. They're like, lost. They didn't know what to do. So this wreck may have been something very similar, and they saw the lighthouse and they ran for it.
He says this later about Foo Fighters. By the power of the pendulum, his last book, he's like, well, I think Foo Fighters were these light balls that were the spirits of airmen who had been killed. And they were confused or perhaps angry or perhaps still interested in what was going on in the war. And so that's why they were seen by other pilots. These were the spirits of dead airmen.
That's certainly an intriguing idea. But with this, though...
But this is like some psychokinesis.
This is a psychokinetic, right? Basically what it is, this is the psychokinetics of the deranged mind. And what he means by this is not, a blight upon these poor lighthouse keepers. He just says these men, they were traumatized. They were helpless. There was nothing they could do. They witnessed this horrible wreck. There was no type of, post-debriefing and trauma counseling back then. And these guys just got worse and worse and worse. And what happened was that trauma manifested psychokinetically, and that's why this lighthouse was haunted. It was haunted by their thoughts.
Was there more activity after that initial
night? It went crazy. After that initial night, it went crazy, and that's why they had to leave, because it was haunted by these poltergeist-like, phenomena. And so this is where he's kind of putting his theories together. And it must be that he has grown and changed, over the years. But in this particular book, that's where he was, focusing it on. But he's also had, other experiences where on this island as well, where he had a colleague, and the colleague kind of went up and he's like, he's going to eat his lunch. And he took his coat and he took his lunch pail and he walks up this hill and he sits on this particular stone, right? And when he sits on the stone, he goes to eat his lunch and it's gone. His lunch pail's gone. His coat's gone. Like, he just looked out into the sea and he turns around and it's all gone. You got to remember, these are remote islands. There's no one there. There's no one playing tricks. Well, there's no humans playing tricks. And he's like, what the hell is going on? So he runs back to the ship and he goes and tells Lethbridge. And Lethbridge is like, no, come on. And everyone was laughing at him. There was this kind of sense of incredulity, and just being, it's just absurd. But apparently another person who was with them was like, oh, you must have encountered the she. It's spelled S-I-T-H, but it's apparently pronounced she. And the she are these traditional folk stories of these like entities, like fairies, essentially, that live on this island. And it's funny that he kind of goes up to this particular location. You've got to wonder, did the rock from like those Icelandic folklore-ish, tales that we have, that that particular rock was inhabited by one of these things and it had taken his objects?
Yeah, you're sitting on their home.
Well, he comes up with the idea that this was some type of psychokinetic apport, or the reverse of an apport, essentially, that for whatever reason, the psychokinetic energy, and possibly because someone here was believing in fairies, it had somehow channeled through and had caused this thing to disappear. We never really get to the bottom of it, but this is where it starts to, give him some ideas about what's occurring with this stuff. What possibly could be happening here? It's not necessarily entities at first, but maybe they become entities later on. And this relates to an experience that he had in this row of houses years later. So he essentially years later finds out, and he's obviously made a lot of contacts and many other open-minded people that, are interested in digging into this deeper and understanding what's going on. And it really was heating up to being, we've had the spiritualism movement. So people were willing to embrace, some of these ideas. And he goes to this row of houses, and this row of houses that used to have been a school of some kind, I believe, or it was connected to a monastery. And there were students that would stay there, and it hadn't been for a while, but there was a canon. You know, there was this canon that was staying there, and obviously other masters of this house. And it was a row of houses, I think it was like 55, 56, and 57. And these particular houses had strange phenomena, strange ghostly phenomena, apparitions, you know, hauntings, poltergeist type activity associated with them. And it had been there for a long time. It had this long history of this kind of stuff, you know, typical haunted house, you know, kind of style. And so he goes to stay at this house, and nothing really happened. Like, there wasn't anything that was going on, except for one particular evening, he says he encounters it. He encounters the ghoul, like he feels it. And it was after a colleague of his had come running down the stairs. He'd be like, "It's the ghost. It's here. I've experienced it. It's here." And he's like, "Well, what do you mean? What's the ghost?" He's like, the wall, the coldness, I felt it." So the theory was, the story had gone, is that many, many years ago, is that there was some type of ghost or apparition that was associated with this particular staircase and this little kind of room, which was now covered over, and this bathroom. And he's like, "Okay, let's go check it out." So he goes with his friend, and they kind of halt there, put their arm in arm.
Yeah, they're very brave.
They're very brave, right? And they start moving up the stairs. They put their foot on the stair, the first stair. And as soon as they do, they feel that cold, right? But what's really intriguing about this is that this mass, even though they can't see it, maybe they can see it with their mind's eye or something, but they don't describe seeing it, but they can definitely feel it, right? And guess what it starts doing? It starts stepping back. It's like they step up.
It tries to get to the top of the stick.
And they're pushing it up, right, as they go. So they do. They walk up and they keep walking up the stairs, and they push up and they bump into it, and they step back a little bit, and then they go up again. And they push it all the way to the top of the stairs. And then it kind of like, I don't know, like a, I don't know, it's like a gaseous formation kind of, I don't know, moves around them or leaks. It's just like, it's just everywhere.
It's back behind them.
And it's back behind them, right? It's moved behind them, and then it kind of just disappears. Now, they go running down the stairs and are, you know, excited and jovial about what's just taken place. And they're not really that fearful, but I think there was an element of fear that was coming in where they were like, okay, that's enough of that. You know, we're not going to do that. But this little story comes out later on, right? And this is where it fits in with his idea about it being a field of some kind, about it being an energy, and about how you can use, and this should have been the headline instead of dead French dogs. It should have been the ghost jammers, because this is where he starts to understand the jamming of these signals, because he really develops this hypothesis that what people are experiencing is essentially the apparitions, the manifestations of the thoughts and the energies of the senders. So remember I said you talked about the receivers and he's one? There's a whole heap of other people that are senders, right? And you can jam it. You can stop it. Now, he actually says this also works with neurotic people at awkward dinner conversations. So he says what you do, and I think you might recall, Ben, where this fits in with a recent story we did about aliens, right? He says that, look, if you're at a dinner party and you're talking to someone who's rather boring or, you know, completely self-absorbed, he's like, it's rather, you know, it's a rather rude thing to do, but they don't know I'm doing it, so I just do it anyway. And, you know, when they're ranting on about themselves over and over and droning, he says he starts saying just a rhyme. He has a rhyme over and over and over in his head. He's like, there once was a man from Ireland. And he keeps on going over and over, right?
I see what you're saying. And this was the same thing that was described. Was it Terry Lovelace? Or no, it must have been someone else. But they're basically saying the way to stop an alien abduction was to have song lyrics ready to go. And when the activity starts, you just start singing that song in your head over and over again. And it throws them off. They can't control your mind. They can't do anything.
Which makes me wonder. I was thinking, is like the whole, because I think that wasn't it some, you know, government organization that understood how to stop them. And I'm thinking, is the phenomenon, you know, what we're talking about here with Lethbridge, is it more like there is like a consciousness element to it?
How does that stop the boring dinner guest?
So what it does though, so when you start, you're sitting there, because when I'm having a conversation with someone, right, you're forming a link with that person. Mm-hmm. And it's like your energies are kind of intertwining, and it all sounds very unhygienic, but essentially like that's what's going on. You're forming this link. And so if you've got someone who won't shut up and is extremely boring, by you doing this repeated rhyme in your head as you're standing there going, uh-huh, mm-hmm. Oh, fascinating. Oh, yes. Inside your head, it's like over and over. What it does is it causes the person to lose energy because it's a jammer. It jams their signal. It says it works every time. They're like, oh, well, I guess the conversation, I have nothing else to say. And then they go away.
Perfect.
It's a very effective tool, apparently. And he says this also works when you're jamming the ghost transmissions in a home. So this particular series of houses, 55, 56, and 57, where all this phenomena are taking place, a lot of stuff had happened over many, many years. But because there was a canon, because there was church people there that were believers in this kind of stuff, right? There was a belief. And this is what he says as well. The other thing, a conclusion that he makes in his book, one is that time as we know it doesn't exist. But two is that the huge factor that plays a role here is faith. It's not necessarily, you know, religious faith, even though that is one element of it. Mm. It's actually faith in the phenomenon. It's like, you're, again, what is faith? Faith in a way is intention. Like it's the way that you, you know, mold the reality around you. He even goes, I didn't go into it in too great a detail because I was running short on time, but he then starts, you know, positing the idea that, you know, even Jesus was just a normal person who had, you know, an understanding of this. And so because he had an understanding of this, this is why he could perform his miracles, because he was able to, you know, influence the reality around us, which is an interesting concept. But really faith, you know, plays a strong role. That's not to say that there's no God and there's no nothing like that. It's just suggesting that in this reality, you actually can manipulate it. You can, you know, cause it to do what you want. So in this particular house, because of all the hauntings that had happened over the years, they'd gone through and done a total cleanse. They'd splashed holy water everywhere. They'd put crucifixes up, you know, done all this kind of stuff. They hadn't done it in that particular stairwell or that bathroom.
Right. Okay.
And he ends up finding that they pull off one of the panels and there was this weird kind of room that possibly may have stored a corpse at one point. And
has, what?
Like all those elements that are kind
it's
of thrown.
Weird pentagram under the toilet.
No, that's not said. It's not really like that. But yeah, this idea that like when a person passes away, there's still a lot of energy, you know, associated with their corpse and that kind of stuff. So that's kind of, I think, you know, where he goes with that. But there's this other element to the story, which is really fascinating. Is that, you know, he goes out and he leaves, but I think he ends up, he's still got contacts with people there. And it was a while later, but a new canon had come in, and this, or a new master, I'm sorry, had come in. And he had no knowledge, apparently, of what was going on. Lethbridge says, look, there's a possibility that people had made a passing comment to him like, oh, that's the haunted stairwell. You have to stay away from there or don't let the ghost get you, something like that. But he's like, I've got no way of knowing that. And he says, it's probably unlikely anyway. And I think, yeah, he's, you know, it probably is unlikely. I mean, if there are a bunch of people that know about a haunting, maybe they'd say something, but I think it was probably a little bit more reserved, you know. So this particular master, he awakens one evening and he's all freaked out. Like he's so freaked out and he comes running down the stairs, just like, oh my God, this is the worst nightmare. Oh, it was awful. Essentially, this bathroom where this form had manifested, right, this ghoul, he has this dream. Now look, yes, it's a dream, but it fits in with this haunted bathroom. He's like this form, like this gas kind of bellowed out, this feeling, everything bellowed out of this bathroom in my dream. And out from it walked a diminutive hairy little man.
What?
Like a mini foot. This little mini Bigfoot, like with gray kind of hair.
Fully covered in hair.
Fully covered in hair.
Like a little monkey like man.
A little monkey man, a little Bigfoot monkey man wanders out. And he's like, what was the most terrifying, truly horrifying thing about it is it was friendly. He's like, it was friendly. And it was like trying to get to my bed and it was friendly.
That's adorable.
Oh, yeah, I'm like, oh, how gorgeous. No, but it was truly, and obviously it must have been because his
wait, his is beliefs. This another story that ends with it just being a macaque? It just was a monkey.
Someone had said a monkey loose. No, it was a dream, right? But the reason why it stands out, and you know, Lethbridge makes this kind of, he, you know, it's tenuous. But it's fascinating nonetheless, right? He points out that, look, not too far from where this particular house is, only a couple of weeks beforehand, right, where this man in that particular room where that stairwell where I'd experienced the ghoul, this form, you know, and thoughts, you know, manifesting this kind of stuff. And obviously I'm, you know, condensing all of this and kind of pulling everything from a very wide time, you know, span to put this together. But he says that there was a very famous story that only occurred a few weeks before and not too far from this location. It was the Dartmoor Hairy Hands.
No way.
Yeah, and if you don't recall that story, just in a nutshell, essentially, it was a guy riding along on a bicycle.
Yeah, classic.
And as he's riding along on a
motorcycle,
bicycle.
Motorcycle, right?
Oh, maybe a motorcycle. It doesn't matter. He was just riding along, you know, on this machine. And out of nowhere, these two disembodied hairy hands appear, grab hold of his handlebars and try to pull him off the road. Like it's a
disembodied hairy hands.
Disembodied hairy hands. Now, this guy who's not too far away in time or space suddenly has a dream about a hairy little figure coming out of this ghoul. Is there a connection there? I don't know. So, I mean, Lethbridge...
Well, Nick Redfern's got all those stories of the...
The hairy hands.
The
There's
hairy,
many of them.
The weird little monkeys, little yeah. hairy monkeys that are seen across the UK. And of course, it's always, well, there's obviously not a real physical population of apes
well, their hands in the UK.
It's obviously something else.
Yeah. So, I mean, the idea is here is that, you know, where Lethbridge is kind of going, is it possible that, without even, you know, focusing on it directly, this is the important part as well when we talk about forms like tulpas and that kind of stuff and thought forms, is that normally with a thought form or a tulpa, you expect that you have to focus heavily on it, right? The more intention you give it, the more energy kind of, you know, comes about. But that's not necessarily the case. If you've already got some energy field which is sitting dormant in a certain location, for example, this particular, you know, unblessed bathroom, he's heard about in the news about these hairy hands, it's sitting in the back of his mind, right? But it starts forming. It starts forming some intention. That intention collides with this bathroom. It causes this effect to take place. I don't know. I don't know if that's necessarily exactly what happened, but it's just strange that you do have this kind of, you know, incident. And apparently there were three more incidents of this kind of stuff going on with other people.
Of little monkey men.
I don't know if it was little monkey men, but similar kind of stuff that was happening. So he's like, look, there is something to this, you know, and it's like there's an energy here. And basically what this energy is a resonance. And this is where it starts crossing into the whole, you know, idea of Rupert Sheldrake and that kind of stuff and the idea of morphic fields and those sorts of things. So he points out that, look, magic does exist, but magic is in fact a control over psychokinesis. You can use it to cause outcomes, and this includes causing apparitions to appear in people's homes, causing illness to take place, causing spontaneous healings to take place. The human mind can supply the field with almost any type of information, tap into this resonance, and create telepathic broadcasts. And these telepathic broadcasts are when people see apparitions in their homes. So going back to what I was describing with, you know, the water there, this is something that comes up. But look, water itself doesn't seemingly store any type of, I mean, yes, water stores energy, right? But the types of energies that we're describing, it doesn't appear to hold that, right? We can't prove that. And yet time after time, you have these alternative researchers that find that's exactly what's going on. So with these telepathic broadcasts, I want to bring you back to this story of this old woman at Mole Hill. And so this happened back in February of 1959, right? This is a very, very old story. So I call it Hole Hill. It's Hole Mill, which is the
not Mole Hill. Hole Mill.
Yes.
Yeah.
So with this particular location, essentially he was wandering around this place, and he'd been there for quite a while. He was living there. He had neighbors and acquaintances, but, you know, sparsely populated. And one particular day, he just has this feeling, right? This kind of feeling to go outside, and he wanders outside, and he looks over and he sees this bald-headed man. And at first I'm thinking, oh, well, clearly he's seeing an apparition. Like, that's what I think it was set up to be like
a man
that.
Who's bald.
But then he's like, then he turns around and it's the postman, right? Okay. It's just the postman. So the postman goes, and then he sees this woman. It's a Mrs. N. And she's standing in her yard, and he kind of waves to her, and she waves back. And, you know, it was just waving to his neighbor, right? But then he notices, and so does his wife, that there's this other woman standing behind her. And this woman seems to be she's all in black clothes. You know, she's got a little bit of dark gray, like a shawl or something. She's got this hat on, and she's just standing a distance from her, like not too far, but a bit of a distance. And he and his wife say, oh, you know, we must go over and she's got a guest. We must go over and visit her, something along those lines. But it just so happens that they're standing next to this stream of water, like this particular stream. And he gets it. He feels something, like he taps into something, like there's a feeling. It's not necessarily the ghoul, but it's the same kind of thing, right? And he's picking up on it. And his wife is like, oh, what's that? Like, oh, I can feel like this energy that's moving through. And at this point in the book, which I'll link to in the show notes so you can go and read it in full detail for yourself, but this is where he starts kind of spitballing ideas as to what could be occurring here. He's like, well, maybe there's some type of, you know, movement in the electrons and the energy that's coming through. And he just doesn't know exactly what it is, but he thinks that this particular movement of water where he is allowing him to pick up on something, feel something. But we don't know entirely what until a little bit later, right? It all comes full spread when they run into Mrs. N. And Mrs. N comes up. And normally Mrs. N, she has these dogs, and these dogs are quite yappy when there's other people around and that kind of thing. And they were with him and his wife. but they hadn't been with this other guest. And they have this polite, cordial conversation with Mrs. N. And he's like, oh, you know, will you bring your guest out to come and meet us? We'd love to meet her. She's like, what the hell are you talking about? And he's like, no, I saw you this morning. She's like, there's no one else here. I saw the mailman and I saw you. I waved to you. That's it. And he's like, no, but right behind you was this woman and she was wearing this hat and she had all this black clothing and she had this particular style of dress on and this hat.
After he describes her, does Mrs. N know who it is?
Yeah, she's straight away. She's like, oh, that's actually a family member of mine who's recently deceased. Like, it's an uncanny depiction of her. And he's, and of course, he's like, well, that doesn't necessarily mean it is. But I'm like, mate, you're trying to make the argument that this is some type of weird telepathic broadcast. Like, come on, let's go with it. But he's like, well, we don't know necessarily that that's what's going on. But what we do find out, right, is that he was standing next to this part of the river or part of this stream that was going past. And that seemingly facilitated him being able to see this form, right? It somehow formed this link where he was able to. Now, this woman couldn't see it. Mrs. N, she couldn't see the other apparition, but it might have been in her mind, this thought. And this was telepathically beaming out. And because he was standing next to like an energy source, which was the movement of this water, that facilitated this entire scene to unfold before him, right? Later on, and when they're talking to Mrs. N, he describes it. He's just like, oh, this is incredible. She's like, oh, yes, that particular area right over there, it's got some weird hole. Like, it just seems to be in space-time. And she doesn't say space-time, but she's like, describes this particular area. And she's like, I hear voices coming from it all the time.
Oh, okay. So some kind of portal to it's another like dimension voices. In your backyard.
There's voices that come from this thing. And it's this one particular spot. So this happens.
Do little monkey men come out of there?
No, there's no monkey men that come out. And so it's really fascinating though, because he starts to try, and I like this, he tries to understand what's happening with this. Like what the hell is with this particular site? So he thinks that there's something atmospheric taking place. And it is pointed out later on that with atmospheric stuff, you find that when people have experiences of hauntings and that kind of thing, there's an increase in solar activity, you know, in solar storms, that kind of stuff. So maybe that's, you know, playing with this. But he goes back to the exact time the following year. He thinks, I'm going to wait a year and come back at the exact same time. And he says, we don't see anything, but we do experience something very strange because they normally don't experience this, right? It seems so there is some type of environmental factor that's taking place. He says, we encounter this atmosphere of electrical tingling. Like it's right, it's like a few, and he can feel it. He's like, it's a few paces away from this particular tree, yeah. And it's the most strongest over this drain, which is under this stream, which is going on. This tingling can be felt all around, but the moment that you step away from it, it's nothing. It just vanishes. Like it's just gone. And it seems to be at this particular moment, exactly this particular moment. And so all these things seem to take place to cause this particular energy to start manifesting, which then taps into the people around it, which allows these telepathic broadcasts to take place. And so maybe, I mean, this, I can see where he starts getting the idea that there are essentially points, right? There's pressures that cause these manifestations to take place.
He really always does land on this idea of it being some kind of psychokinetic construction, right?
Definitely.
You know, he seems to be always moving away from this idea of it just being a ghost.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's the simplest explanation.
Well, you know, later on, though, he starts going into the idea that he doesn't use the term, right? But he describes essentially Vardigas. And, you know, the lighthouse story potentially could kind of maybe be a Vardiga. If you're not familiar with that term, a Vardiga is traditionally, I think it's a Norwegian term, but traditionally what happens is a person will be sitting in their home, and normally from the older stories, it'd be like a housewife waiting for her husband to come home, and she'll hear the husband come home, and he'll walk up the back stairs, he'll jingle his keys, you know, he'll do all the kind of normal things he does when he comes home. She goes out to greet him, and he's not there. But then he'll come home half an hour later and then wander upstairs and do exactly the same thing. It's like a pre-arrival, right? There's some type of, and he starts linking these ideas in with intention though. And he says, but with his particular stories, it's like there's this one case where there was a woman that she had gone through a very similar kind of experience. Her husband came home. Now, with a normal Vardiga experience, you never see them. Like, there's just no visual apparition of them. And this is what plays in with a lot of his work, because there's a whole heap of experiences where you never see anything. You just experience the feeling of it, right? Well, with his experiences, which are Vardigas but not described as Vardigas, there's a full physicality to them. An incredible physicality to them. So what I will do is I will describe some of those stories in our Plus extension coming up right after this. And Ben, you're going to go into further details about his pendulum research.
Yeah, so ultimately, Lethbridge discovered a way to use the pendulum to essentially uncover what he thought was a code, almost like a massive directory of every single object, every single individual, every single concept, thought. Everything in the universe is catalogued. And through his system, you could find the reference in the catalogue using the pendulum. It allowed him, he claimed, to peer into other dimensions, to see the existence of things in another level beyond us and another level beyond that. It really gets wild with what he started to uncover with his later research. I'm also going to be talking about missing 411 cases solved with dowsing and the pendulum.
Oh, really?
And how the CIA got involved with pendulum research in the 1950s.
All right. I'm also going to go into how intention plays a role in telephone calls from the dead. Sometimes
dogs.
The dogs. Not necessarily the dog isn't a big thing, but yes, how that plays a role in this kind of stuff and how this may actually be, you know, kind of an umbrella hypothesis which will explain much of the supernatural phenomena that people experience.
If you want to get access, head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today and we'll give you the extensions on these shows every single Friday. Plus members also get an exclusive season that comes out every Tuesday. More than double the content if you sign up for Plus. Plus members also get a totally ad-free version of the show. You get access to a higher bitrate feed. And if you sign up for the MU Max tier, you get access to our entire back catalogue going back more than a decade. Again, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. Sign up today. Help support your favourite show. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. We'll link to all the Lethbridge stuff in the show notes. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll catch you next week.
Extension, and I just wanted to just